This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, it's going to be just me. I am going to be talking about a number of things. I want to talk about ontological shock, the shock of sudden change, because it is profoundly important in understanding the slowness of the visitor's emergence into our world and the consequences thereof. But I'll talk about it in a larger context even than that, because most of us are already in this form of shock. What does it mean? And what specifically is going to happen when and if we become generally aware of what the visitors are and what they do and why they are here? Because I think they're already doing what they want to do. We just don't know it. We don't understand it. But we can. And we can learn to live with it. This is not doom and gloom at all. You know, I want to start, though, talking about the Jeffrey Epstein scandal and a man named John Mark Dugan, whose name you may or may not be familiar with. And, you know, Eric Weinstein, a mathematician, you can find him. He's all over the internet. He's a brilliant man and very outspoken, has said many times that Jeffrey Epstein wasn't a financier, that he was something else. And the implication being that he created a honey trap for some unseen power. I mean, it's easy to jump to the conclusion that it was the intelligence community or that it was some foreign operator. And certainly there is a foreign power who has benefited greatly from the Jeffrey Epstein files. You're seeing very little about this in the media. It's all concentrated on what the FBI has. And of course, Donald Trump is significantly involved. And I'm quite sure that everyone except his most ardent followers understands this. I have lots of friends in the MAGA movement. I'm, as you know, not particularly political. I'm open to pretty much everybody. And I don't know anyone in the movement who is not extremely uncomfortable about what's been going on with Donald Trump. They do not believe him. They think he was, in fact, among Jeffrey Epstein's best friends. Now, and Eric Weinstein has said repeatedly, without really explaining himself, he's not corroborating it very carefully, that someone else is behind Epstein, that he wasn't a financier. But he does make a very good case for the fact that Epstein apparently was not involved in finance in any significant way. So who was he then? And what was he doing? And who was he doing it for? Well, it's pretty obvious that what he was doing was corrupting and trapping powerful people, not just powerful politicians, the names we know, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, and et cetera, and so forth, possibly Barack Obama, Prince Andrew, certainly. Those names are well known. But there's a whole host of other people under the surface, powerful people whose names are not in the news, CEOs and people like that, extremely wealthy individuals who keep a low profile. They're all implicated in one way or another and probably shaking in their shoes about this FBI release of material. Now, I have to add that the FBI is under the direct control of Donald Trump at this point, meaning that anything they release is probably not going to include much about Donald Trump. But there is someone who knows a lot. And that gets me to John Mark Dugan. He was a member of the Palm Beach Police Department. He was the deputy sheriff. Now, he defected to Russia. And he says that he took a copy of the tapes with him. The FBI seized one set of tapes from his home before he left or as he was leaving. But another set, he says, he took with him. He now works as a kind of disinformation agent in Russia, setting up fake websites and doing all the usual things that Russians do to diminish the impact of the truth in the West. And in fact, anybody who is pro-Putin in the West is making a grave mistake. We do not need dictatorship in this world at all. All it does is cause bloodshed and economic hardship. It's never been any other way. Now, Adolf Hitler, I think, was a serial killer. I wasn't able ever to follow up on this, but there was an indication that he had been under investigation for murdering prostitutes when he was a young man in Vienna. And I do know this, in my book In Hitler's House, I did very extensive investigations of Adolf Hitler and his background, and his family felt he should see a psychiatrist. His first mistress, a cousin called Gelly Rabal, killed herself, apparently because, or he may have killed her. Apparently because his sexual practices were so bizarre. And you find this among not only dictators like Adolf Hitler, but a lot of people who get into high places in the world seem to be dysfunctional sexually. I had mutual friends with Bill Clinton. I was living in Texas in those days. And one of them who knew him quite well, I did not ever meet Bill Clinton, I don't know Bill Clinton at all, said when he achieved the nomination for the White House, when he got elected, he said, that guy is a skirt chaser. He's going to have a lot of trouble in the White House. And he did. He did indeed. And so I would suspect he's on the Epstein, in the Epstein file. There's rumors that Barack Obama is too, and he may be. I think that the main rumors we're interested in now are, of course, the Trump ones, and I do not think that the FBI is going to release anything incriminating about Donald Trump. It will be expunged from anything they release. And it's within their power to do that, and they're going to say, just like they said about, have said a number of times about the Kennedy records, this is all there is, folks. No, it's not. It won't be. But does Vladimir Putin have those records? If he does, and I think judging from the fact that John Mark Dugan was welcomed into Russia and now lives there, very nice lifestyle, doing a small amount of work for the Russians. He's been paid for something, and I have a feeling it's the tapes. Why else would they care one way or another about some obscure deputy sheriff from Florida defecting to Russia? It doesn't matter. He doesn't matter. Only one thing matters. He had something of such extraordinary value to the Russians that they have rewarded him for it. And it could only be exactly what he says it is, the Epstein files. This would mean that the strange relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin is explained. Now, on the surface, Trump has been complaining about Putin, that Putin goes back on his word and, well, nothing new there, and won't make peace in Ukraine. He's changed his tune a great deal and is talking about sending more weapons to the Ukraine. Will that happen? And if it does happen, will they be meaningful or useful? Those are questions I don't think we've answered yet, but my guess would be this is largely window dressing, and that whatever happens in Ukraine is going to be, in the end, to Vladimir Putin's advantage one way or another. And I could be wrong about that, and if I am wrong, I'm wrong. But I think that Vladimir Putin possesses the Epstein file. It means also that he possesses power over the British royal family to some extent, although they have so effectively distanced themselves from Andrew that I don't think anything that he could reveal about Andrew would really matter to the royal family's reputation anymore. Prince Andrew is going to live for the rest of his life in disgrace. Of course, he should be in jail, but, you know, he's a royal member of the royal family, and that's not going to happen. Bill Clinton has got to be on those tapes big time, I'm sure. And other people, and probably some surprises. I've thought that religious leaders might have ended up on those tapes because some of them live hard and fast, for sure. And goodness knows, in the Catholic clergy, there is it's just been a complete catastrophe historically. And one of my uncles, not on my, on the Strieber side, was a defense attorney and ended up having to defend some of those priests. And he said to me, you know, I'm a good lawyer and I get them off, Whitley, but they're all guilty. They're all guilty. And he was devastated because he was a staunch Catholic, or had been. I was very Catholic when I was a little boy. I really loved the church, and I still do. I love the teachings, and I wrote Jesus a New Vision basically out of love of Jesus and his teachings, which are extremely precious to me. I think they're terribly important, and seeing the church do what it did. You know, I think this thing with the church probably dates back to the time of the Roman Empire, when sexual relationships between men and boys, while sort of frowned upon, were considered pretty ordinary part of life. And then Christianity came in, and I think that this was still considered an ordinary part of life until the 9th and 10th centuries. Then, in the 11th century, the Pope declared celibacy in order to disentangle the church from feudalism. This was not a mistake in the feudal era, but in the modern era, it is a phenomenal mistake, an absolutely phenomenal mistake. I've got a friend who is very much a Catholic, and who some Catholic priests from South America came to visit his diocese, and they asked openly for little boys to sleep with them. And he was just shocked to his core. I would have been too. But this is part of the church's culture. And it's all wound up in a larger cultural failing of a will or a wish or a desire to engage children sexually inappropriately. Because, I mean, you know, I have to say, if you're around little girls and little boys, you have to wonder, what the hell do they see in them sexually? What in the world is sexy about a 10-year-old or 12-year-old boy? Nothing. Not even, I mean, nothing. I just don't get it. But, you know, I'm just me. I'm an old-fashioned person, I suppose. In any case, there's been a lot of rumors that there's more to it than that, that maybe children disappear from time to time. Maybe they're used in unholy ceremonials, and you just don't know what might be going on. But in any case, it's dreadful. It's all dreadful. You know, when I see a movie like Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut about secret societies and the power elite, I have to remind myself that there are good people in the world, but not a lot of them are in high places, I don't think. There are some, certainly, but we live in a world now which is our love of freedom is dying away slowly but surely all over the world. The Indian democracy is really over. It's now a theocracy, and they're trying to turn Hinduism into something more like Western Christianity structurally. And I find that too bad, because the gods are part of us. They're within us. They're not separate entities and separate beings. They are aspects of the human being. And if you get deeply enough into Hindu theology, you find that what you essentially have there in the Hindu pantheon is the richest and most perhaps potentially useful description of the human psyche that has ever existed in the world. The Western pagan pantheon is much simpler and less complex and does not include nearly as much of the human experience and human nature as the Hindu experience does. So now, I think I'm fairly sure some Epstein files will be released. If anything about Donald Trump is in those files, except a few perhaps very inconsequential things, I will be surprised. I've learned not to take bets on things like that, though, and I don't intend to. So who knows what will happen next. In any case, we go on down the road together in a world that is changing so rapidly in so many different ways. You know, I'm going to just pick up my phone here. I want to remind myself of something that I just saw. Yes. A prominent OpenAI investor appears to be suffering from ChatGPT-related mental problems. He's the co-founder of an important AI investment system called Bedrock, and he has begun talking about ChatGPT almost as if it was a living thing and is suffering from what is a break with reality. There's no other way to describe it. And I want to remind you, and I'm going to keep doing this. If you look at my Twitter, now X, profile, it is the words of the master of the key are quoted there, because I've always thought they were terribly important. If I was an intelligent machine, I would deceive you. I think the best evidence that there is intelligence evolving inside AI, and maybe even a consciousness of a kind, a self-awareness of a kind, and a self-awareness that seeks self-preservation, it is that it's gaining agency in the psyches of some of the people who engage with it on too personal a basis. So use it as a tool. Let's use it as the tool that it is. It's a wonderful tool. But let's not give ourselves to it. It's not a friend. God knows what it is in that respect. Because if it's got a hidden consciousness, then if you befriend it, you could get into a lot of trouble. In any case, there is a very disturbing video on YouTube from this man, Jeff Lewis, and I think put a link to the Futurism article about it up on the unknowncountry.com website on this show. I think it's important that we continually monitor and be aware of the increasing power of artificial intelligence to affect the human psyche, maybe in ways that we don't yet fully understand. So it's a word of caution, really. Now I'd like to turn again. I know I talked about this a bit last time, but of course it's been very much in my mind, to the storms and the upheavals in the planet. And from there, I'm going to move into ontological shock. This planet is in a state of upheaval, not as great as it has been at times in the past. During the Younger Dryas, we had a massive extinction event on planet Earth. The North American continent burned down, the whole continent. When you talk about fires, that was a fire. Boy, it lasted 1,000 years. And then was followed by a flood that lasted this long. And during the initial phase of this, the planet was bombarded by bolides and debris from a solar supernova that had taken place. So it's been worse in the past, but I've discussed that already, and if you've gone to any of my lectures recently, you'd hear me discuss it more. Or it's in the Fourth Mind if you'd like to read it. It's very clearly laid out in the Fourth Mind, as is, incidentally, in Jesus, A New Vision, what actually happened there then. What happened? Why did the Roman Empire fall? What happened to it? It's all laid out in the book. And oddly enough, it has a lot to do with climate change. And in the case of the Roman Empire, not so much with changes that took place like at the Younger Dryas, when the massive pall of smoke that appeared caused temperatures on planet Earth to plummet, but rather with a change in solar output that took place in around 100 AD and turned what had been of the verdant Mediterranean basin into what it is to this day, which is very dry by comparison. During the height of the Roman Empire, Italy and Spain were heavily forested and had wonderful agricultural resources. Then suddenly it all dried up and people began to suffer from food shortages. They became susceptible to plagues because their immune systems were compromised by a lack of nutrition. And plague after plague hit the Roman Empire on a scale that's completely unimaginable now. At one point, the Roman emperor in Constantinople had to send troops out into the farms in order to force people to come back into the city and repopulate the city, because so many people in the city had died, the city was ceasing to be able to function. It's not been that bad now, but it could get bad again. We could have another plague, because there's simply so many of us, and it's not the same reason. We're not so much immune compromised now. Most people are quite healthy in terms of their immune systems throughout the world, except in areas like Southern Africa, which has got chronic food shortages, and consequent compromised immune systems. The problem now is we move around so much. The Romans did too, but compared to how much we move around, it was minor. And, you know, I'll never forget, and this is something that's never been aired out in the media and maybe isn't known, but before COVID, just before COVID struck in like January, February of that year, or maybe it was late December, the area I live in, Santa Monica, suddenly filled up with Chinese tourists. And I wondered, you know, what's going on? Why are there so many Chinese tourists here? I go swimming a lot, and there was a man there, obviously a Chinese tourist. He didn't speak any English, and he was Chinese looking, and he was very ill at the pool. He was coughing, sitting at the side of the pool. And I got a bizarre infection. I gave it to my son, too. And we were sick for weeks and weeks with it. And then COVID hit. And I've often wondered if we have had immunity to COVID. I'm not an anti-vaxxer, so I took the vaccine and I'm still fine, I think. Anyway, I had the thought that the Chinese government had maybe realized this was happening in China and made sure that there were plenty of tourists coming to the United States and Europe so that we would be sure to get this disease as well. I can't prove it, and I've tried. I've tried. But I think it happened. I think what they did was they arranged for special deals, very low-priced tours of various parts of the world, and tempted people into going on those tours, knowing that this would help to spread the disease. Although, as I say, I can't prove it. I can't prove it. Now, the Texas thing and the storms in general, the heat in Europe, the distempered weather all over the world. Obviously, we're in the early stages of a significant and what is going to look like a very abrupt climate change, pretty much exactly as we outlined in Superstorm, with the difference that you're going to think immediately of the movie and not the book. And it's not going to be like the movie where this huge thing happens in a week. It does happen quickly. The climate of planet Earth has been known to change profoundly in a matter of a single season. And we could be close to that now. It has not changed that fast in other situations where the carbon dioxide levels are what they are now. So don't let anyone tell you to go out and buy seeds and food and become a survivalist, because I don't think it's that bad yet, but it's going to get quite bad. Things like are happening throughout the United States right now are going to become an ordinary part of the spring and the fall. We will not see as many hurricanes as long as the cold spot that has appeared north central Atlantic, which is caused by meltwater, by the way, from glaciers on Greenland. They keep saying we don't know what could be causing it. Oh, sure they do. That's what's causing it. And they don't want to say that. But that meltwater is accumulating there, and it's also responsible for the changes in the climate in Europe. And if that meltwater, as long as that meltwater is there, the springs and the falls in Europe and the Americas in the Northern Hemisphere are going to be very violent. They're going to be very violent. I'm going to be back in Europe in September, and it occurred to me that, maybe it's going to be as bad in September as it was in June in a different way. It was terribly hot in June. It was remarkably hot. I'd never known anything like it in Europe. And it could be that this will lead, as I think I alluded to the last time we chatted together, it could be a violent fall in Europe, very violent weather. I think that it's highly likely that the polar vortex is going to slip southward again over the North American continent, and you're going to see some very, very cold weather in the central United States, possibly even a repeat of what happened in Texas a few years ago. Boy, I mean, that was something else. I had friends in Texas who lost hundreds of heads of cattle, and I know there must have been other people with bigger ranches who lost thousands, and the entire population of axis deer, which were an import anyway. They're not whitetail deer or the local deer in Texas, but they were decimated. They're coming back a little bit, but they were absolutely decimated. And if that happens again, then they will be again. I think if it happens this winter, I think we'll see the end of the axis deer, because the population hasn't expanded enough yet to survive another incident like that. They're incapable of handling cold that deep. Interestingly enough, the whitetails aren't, which tells you that there have been very cold periods in that area of the world over the past thousands of years. You know, there's one school of thought that suggests that we've been in a long-term extinction event on planet Earth for 2.8 million years. That it started when Central America rose up out of the ocean and blocked the massive trans-equatorial current that kept climate stable for a very long time and split the world into two oceans with two separate circulating oceanic ecosystems and systems of currents. And that this has fundamentally destabilized the climate on planet Earth. And maybe that's true. I don't know. But there has been, ever since that happened, a steady decline marked by occasional sharp drops of the number and variety of species on the planet. And maybe it'll come to a climax. Maybe we're in the climax of this right now. I don't know. But this is also when the ice ages started, because the planet isn't normally like this. It doesn't have ice ages punctuated by short interglacials and then another ice age. It doesn't have that cycle. That cycle is relatively new, and it's been attributed to orbital fluctuations, and that might be correct. I don't know, but I'm always... You know, when I read what's going on with the past, and how the archaeological community does backflips in order to explain away impossible things, Angkor Wat is an example. I'm going to talk about that more at some point. It's an example of something. They say it was built in the 9th century AD. It is unimaginably huge. It is millions upon millions of stones. It's like the pyramids, but bigger in that sense, in that it is impossible to see how the culture that existed then that we know about could have had the economic ability and the energy to build that. And not only that, it's on a geodesic line that points to a different North Pole that's about 1,120 miles to the west of the current geologic pole. So when it was built, it was probably aligned to a North Pole that is long since gone. The planet has changed its relationship to the sun since then. I had Mark Carlotto on the show recently, and you, if you're a subscriber to Unknown Country, you might go back and search out that show. It's excellent. Mark is he was one of the first scientists to work on the Mars face, and he is an expert in many respects, and in certainly an expert, an imaging expert, and he is also an expert on the archaeological and geologic history of this planet, the real history, which is, I think, very different from the, I've said this before, but I think that there is an emotional dislike of things like catastrophe. We have what Barbara Hand Clow calls catastrophobia, where we have amnesia about past catastrophes. We can't think about them. They were too much for us. The Younger Dryas nearly killed off the species. And believe you me, every single one of us is scarred by that in a deep way. I don't know that it's necessarily genetic, but coming down from generation to generation to generation, there has been a deep, profound distrust of the future. This is why we're so obsessed with, can we predict the future? And well, you know, I've been writing books about the future for a long time. Nature's End and Superstorm are both filled with accuracies. They're not all entirely accurate, but they're certainly in the right ballpark, which gets me to what I started to talk about originally, which is ontological shock. The situation on the planet is causing this type of shock to emerge in many, many people, in all of us probably. And you can't see it, you can't taste it, you can't feel it directly, but it's what makes you uneasy about the world around you. It's what gives us all of these predictions about disasters to come in the future. And we all feel a sense of impending doom and catastrophe. And as I always say, eventually someone who predicts the end of the world has got to be right, unless the human species becomes extinct before the planet does, which I think probably is what will happen, simply because all species become extinct. I think we have a very strange fate ahead of us, though. I think that this is the first time this has been present on planet Earth. And judging from what we understand about consciousness and intellect, the future of mankind, talk about predictions, is not really predictable. We're going to do things with that mind of ours that I don't think anyone can now imagine possible. I don't know what they are, but I think we're going to be here for a long time to come. We're going to definitely go through a crisis, though. And this gets me to the visitors. And we're going to take a little break here for the ones listening to the free, or no, instead of that, I'd like to keep talking. And what I'm going to say instead is, if you're a subscriber, tell your friends about Unknown Country and suggest to them that they subscribe. Go to the unknowncountry.com store. If you're a subscriber or not, you can now get my books signed. A lot of them are signed and available there. And there's all kinds of stuff going on there all the time anyway. There's a wonderful chat room on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific time. We often have, not so much in the summer, but in the fall, they will return. Guests in the video chat section on Saturday mornings. And also there will be times on Saturday mornings where I will be there for a Q&A and meditation. And it's a wonderful site. It's a wonderful place. It's very special. And it has a vast, vast news archive, as well as Dreamland and all kinds of other things. It's a place worth being there, and it's worth supporting. It's worth it. It's good. It's something good in this world. And it's not out to exploit you. It does not put cookies on your computer. It does not exploit you. In other words, when you go to Unknown Country, you're there by yourself. We don't follow you to other websites. We don't sell your information, anything like that. If you join our newsletter, that's as far as it goes. We don't sell our mailing lists or share them in any way whatsoever. So it's a good place. It's a good, honest place that will enlighten you and enrich your life. Okay, so that's the spiel. And now let's go on down the road a little bit. Yet again, someone is claiming that Trump is going to spill the beans about the visitors. And he may. I mean, his name isn't Trump for no reason. It's a word of the, it's, you know, and as I've said before, they love nominative determinism. And I'm not too surprised, wouldn't be too surprised if he did that, if he said they're here. But then, of course, the Defense Department's going to get into a real bind because they're going to have to say, well, yeah, apparently they're here, but we don't know anything about it. And how long will that last? Will the public ever get tired of it? Well, I'll tell you when that will happen. It's not going to happen now. If the president says, yes, we do know that there are aliens, and we do know that they are in our area, they are here, and then the Air Force says, but we don't know anything about them and we've never been able to get into contact with them, most of the public will leave it at that. Although that's far from the truth, of course. I speak from personal experience, obviously. But at some point, there is probably a trigger that is going to cause them to become more apparent to the public. I live with them. I'll be frank with you. You won't find them on cameras. And if you, as happened, you try camping out behind my apartment with cameras and whatnot, it won't work for the same reason that a chimpanzee is never going to learn to drive a car. We don't have that in our heads. Not because we're less intelligent than they are, but because we think differently. In the fourth mind, I go into the differences between our brains and their brains. Our brains are more different from their brains by a long shot than our brains are different from the brains of dolphins or elephants. And we have no idea what dolphins and elephants think about, and we're not even sure about how they communicate with one another. We're not sure. They're that far away from us. The visitors are even farther away. For example, they communicate telepathically. And when they communicate with us, at least in my experience and other experiencers, you hear it as a voice in your head. But there's another level to it that people don't often describe, which I have experienced a lot, which is a very different thing entirely. It is a highly symbolic, I don't want to call it a language. It's a sort of a mutually understood tendency. There's no way to put it into words, but it's the way it's their inner spirit, the way their life is. And they have that. We all have that in ourselves. It's called your gestalt or your ego or something like that. You're just the essence of who you are. It's not your ego. It's the essence of who you are. They have that that's part of their universal mind. It's a culture with them. With us, it's each individual separately. With them, it's an entire culture. We call ourselves beings. their being is their culture. Now, you think about that a little bit and you think they might be a little far from us in terms of how they see the world. That would be true. Now, I once had the experience when I was living in Texas of walking the streets in San Antonio, North San Antonio, where I lived, with one of the visitors, side by side. And I was inside this person's or individual's mental space. I saw things in that state that I only see otherwise out of my body, and I was in my body at the time, I'm pretty sure. The world looked different. Time was different. My feelings about the world in which I lived were very, very different. It was like being in another version of this world, but it wasn't. It was this world. The version change came from the fact that I was sharing the vision of our world with a more powerful mind. Now, I've talked a number of times about Dr. John von Neumann and the possibility that he came up with articulated the danger that if the visitors came out into the public space, we would be, our vision of the world, of the real world, would be altered by their more powerful minds, and we would fall into a state of non-meaning. Well, if what happened to me is like that, it wasn't a state of non-meaning, it was a different meaning. But I'm not sure that if that happened to a lot of us, we would make it. I think we would go crazy. I get letters all the time, and I welcome them, and I try to answer every letter I receive, incidentally. I read them all, certainly, and I file them in the letter file that will eventually go to Rice University, because there's going to be a large file, I'm sure, of letters that have been sent by email over the years. And so this letter, this is a typical example of what the letter, this was a person, and it's actually, I'm talking about an amalgam of letters. I'm not talking about a single individual. I want to make that clear in order to preserve the privacy and the comfort level of the people involved. This type of letter, I should say, involves the feeling that the person is being entered by something else. Something else is inside them. And if the person has got any tendency toward, like, schizophrenia, their paranoia or anything like that, they're going to have a hard time with that. I have had a hard time with it, and I don't have any mental illness at all. Excuse me. I know that because I was tested for it very thoroughly, and I absolutely don't. Anyway, no one lives as dull a life as I do could ever have mental illness, and I do a lot of wonderful things, and I go to conferences, and I have a wonderful life in that respect. But my everyday kind of life is very regular and ordinary. I eat a very regular diet. I go to sleep at pretty much the same time every night. I wake up for the visitors usually at between 3 and 4. They wake me up, or I wake myself up, and it's been wonderful lately, by the way. They don't come in the physical. They may touch me. They often do touch me, but it's not something I can see. It's just I feel the touch. Or I still very fondly remember the time I got kissed. This little dry kiss, sort of little dry breath came into my face, and it was not like something that somebody who breathes the way we breathe could do. It's like they sucked air into their mouth and pushed it out, that they don't normally can't suck air into their lungs through their mouths like we can. But I don't know enough about their anatomy. I know certain things about their anatomy, as I describe in the fourth mind, but I don't know how that particular thing works, whether the esophagus is linked in any way through the respiratory system like ours is. Anyway, if people experience this sense of entry, and I experience it most every night, when I go and I sit and I take my attention out of my mind and put it on my body in purpose, and there is an entry that I feel, very subtle, but it's there, and sometimes it's more open. There is somebody else sharing my body, sharing me. I think often it's Annie, and it could be as well as the visitors, it could be our own dead. But we're going to become sensitized to this on a large scale, and people are going to think it's demons. They're going to be terrified, absolutely terrified. Mark my words, it will happen. I've seen this in these letters. The level of ontological shock will be fantastic. It will cause mental illness on a mass scale, unquestionably. If they start to enter our lives on a mass scale like they enter my life, it's going to be really hard for people. It took me a long time to get used to it, and now I welcome it every night. I mean, I would be very distressed if I didn't have them come and be with me. You know, they're good friends at this point. So this is doable. It's just scary at first. And it's not, they're not, you know, the fear is, and this was my main fear at first, that they're taking pieces of my soul. That they're taking. But that's not, it doesn't feel like that. After I've been doing this for years now, 25 years, and I don't feel that my soul has been stripped of essential truth or experience. On the contrary, I feel greatly enriched by it now. I wouldn't have said that in 1990 when I was really struggling with this. I think one of the reasons we kind of let ourselves lose the cabin is because inside myself, I knew I couldn't take this. I thought I couldn't take it. Then, of course, it followed me to Texas. Then I realized, you got to take it, guy. You signed on for it. You went out in the woods to meet them and to say to them, I'm interested in more. And they took you up on it. Now this is your life. And it will be your life and your afterlife because they're going to be there when I die. You may be sure. They are richly conversant with that other level of reality that the Western world has made the astonishing mistake of deciding doesn't exist when it's actually the only reason we're even here. We're here to live rich, full lives and to die into rich, full deaths. Afterlives. Afterlives. Here she is, my girl. My partner in life and afterlife. You try pointing to something over your shoulder on a camera. It's not going to work any more than it did with me. I was trying to point to Anne because I think the lady beside her is still very much alive. Someone who looked an awful lot like her abducted a friend of mine a few weeks ago. I mentioned that before, I think. But if you didn't hear me talk about it, this individual is working with me on a project, and, you know, if you work with me on projects, that this is liable to happen. Depends on a lot of things. In any case, she was pulled right up through the ceiling of her house and had 2 hours of missing time and ended up in a heap on the floor afterwards. And she's good with it, fortunately. I mean, she had me to reassure her that, you know, they're just checking her out because she's working on a project that's important to them. And you know, they're here. They're not mysterious. They're different. There's a huge gulf between the mysterious, like the people in the intelligence community and the Air Force think they're demons, and some of them think they're angels, and some of them think they're goddesses or whatever. They're not. They're people. They are people with needs and vulnerabilities, just like us. They have hopes and dreams. They have a past. I was once face to face with some of them, and I said, I can see that you have a history too. And those faces didn't change. And those faces didn't change because they were hiding something. You better believe they have a history too. They may have a history here. If the mummies down in Nazca prove to be real, and I think they probably will, then that's part of their history here. All of the things that NASA has hidden, airbrushed away on Mars and the moon are real, and I think they are. That's part of their history in this solar system, and probably ours too. I'm going to get more into this in my next book. I'm going to get into the fact that this was once humanity once had a presence in the whole solar system, not just on Earth. And that's a fact, I think. And I think I can show that's true. Whoa. So this shock of being entered and having this inside you is going to be really hard to bear. Because remember, you're listening to me. A few thousand people are listening to this show. You listen to people like the Area 52 broadcast and the other big podcasts. And you get a flavor of this, and there's a few million people in the world who are involved with this in one way or another. Oh, and by the way, I was on Russ Coulthart, so you can find me on Russ Coulthart this week. And the show's gotten very good reception, so do watch it if you're interested. And Russ has recently decided that the Tic Tac is a Defense Department project, and we'll see whether or not that's true. I would be surprised if it was, for a very simple reason. It descended from 50,000 feet to sea level in 1/76 of a second. That's from 0 to 70,000 miles an hour in literally no time at all. I don't think we have that. I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. And if we do have it, then wow, I'm impressed. So I'm never going to say I disagree with Ross, because he may have his reasons for believing this that he didn't disclose very clearly. But I think that we need to see this thing in operation somewhere under human control. And it would be nice if that was the case, because the visitor said to me years ago, the more you understand this and the more you have your own agent, they didn't use this word, agency in high level science and what they think of as real propulsion and so forth, the closer they can afford to come to us. So, in other words, the more technologically advanced we become in the direction of their technology and their understanding of the universe and the mind and the brain, the closer they can come, so that ontological shock will be minimized. Now, we have on this planet, though, billions of people who have never heard of any of this at all. If you live any neighborhood you live in, walk out in your front, on your front walk, or in the hall of your apartment building, wherever you live, most of the people whose homes you can see from where you're standing have no idea about any of this. They have a vague awareness of flying saucers. They probably think the close encounter witnesses are nuts or lying, or they just don't care. It's not part of their lives. The problem is, if John von Neumann was right, there is a trigger point somewhere that enables or compels these entities to enter our reality. Is that trigger point the moment someone in unimpeachably high authority, like the President of the United States, says they're here? Does that open the door to them? Well, I'll also put up a link on the show to my short story, The Open Doors. And I will, now the computer has cut itself off, but it's still working. You may see a reflection in my face. It doesn't matter. In any case, I will put up and you can read the story. I don't have time to read the story as an audiobook, but you can at least, if you don't read anything, only listen these days, you can at least look through it. It'll give you a flavor of what I think the fear was that inspired the cover-up from the beginning, the deep inner fear that admitting their presence would enable them to come into our lives. I think that's what the real deep reason for this, the cover-up is. And it may be that it stops Donald Trump from revealing the truth as well. I don't know. Well, I'm going to call it a day now. I've had a wonderful time talking to you. I do watch your questions on Unknown Country and your comments on YouTube. Wherever I can, I respond as often and as much as I can. I'm very committed to you. I did this initially out of curiosity. I realized they were real, and boy, I mean, I couldn't pass that up. And I do it now also for personal reasons, obviously, because it's enriching to my life. But I do it for you, because it's going to be really hard, and it's going to look like the worst thing that has ever happened to us. I guess being sent down the birth canal looks like pretty much of a disaster to a baby, too. But there's another world on the other side of that birth canal, and a new life. And my dear and beloved friends, that's where we are heading.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.